But I call Mrs. Sarah Flanders of the United States of America, who is co-director of the International Action Center and who has been part also of the International Tribunal for US and NATO crimes in Yugoslavia. You have the floor. I don't know if this is working for the translations. Is it working over there? No, it is not working. So if you can put the other mic more before, yes, perfect.
Good afternoon. First, let me say that the International Action Center and its founder, the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, salutes all of the Belgian comrades and friends and all those who are working on this hearing for the work that they're doing in establishing the fact that elements in U.S. ruling circles, and especially those who became the Bush administration, established a foreign policy for the United States that led it to wage a criminal aggression against Iraq in the spring of 2003. A whole section of the U.S. ruling class, through its think tanks and strategists, the so-called had developed a plan and the justification for a plan. What's useful for a hearing like this today is that they published their plan, the Project for the New American Century, or PNAC, the PNAC, in 1998, 2 years before George Bush slipped into the White House under a dubious election. And this is so useful because it establishes premeditation on the part of the U.S. government with regard to this very serious crime against the people of Iraq and the people of the world. Now, I will not focus on the PNAC itself, as others are developing this point fully. I'd like instead to make a presentation on two main points that continue from the discussion of the ideology of the PNAC. First is, as an additional motive, and one might even call this the driving force, I want to show the connection between the Bush administration and the military-industrial complex, especially the so-called oil lobby, and its impact on the aggression against Iraq. And second, I want to draw from and quote from a Bush administration insider to show that the Bush administration was discussing the implementation of the PNAC from its very first meeting of the National Security Council, long before the attack of September 11, 2001. The whole PNAC plan is based on the assumption that because U.S. ruling circles were willing to use overwhelming force of the Pentagon, that they could overwhelm all opposition. And I hope to end by showing that as of now, a year after the war supposedly ended, nothing is going according to their plan. And really, our task in the anti-war movement should be not just to evaluate their plans and their crimes, but to add to their problems in waging this criminal war. Now, first, on the motive of profit, the driving force. In the first volume of Capital, Karl Marx cites a British trade unionist, T.J. Dunning, on the greed of capitalists. And it's been quoted many times since because it's so powerful and true, and I just want to open by repeating it again. With adequate profit, Dunning said, capital is very bold. A certain 10% will ensure its employment anywhere. 20% certain will produce eagerness, 50% positive audacity, 100% will make it ready to trample all human laws, and at 300% there's not a crime, at which it will scruple, nor a risk it will not run, even to the chance of its owners being hanged. If turbulence and strife will bring profit, it will freely encourage both. Smuggling and the slave trade amply prove all that is here stated. Now, a lot's changed since Dunning said this, but not the attitude of the capitalists. And this was apparent in the period leading up to the March 20th beginning of the invasion of Iraq. The oil lobby in the United States, the military contractors, the banks that finance them, all of them hoped to grow fabulously rich from the war. And these same businesses were closely connected with the neoconservative ideologists in the Bush administration who also hoped to grow rich from the war. They believed that their friends and associates and they themselves have the right to grow rich as much as they believe in any more complicated ideology. Ideology and self-interest and class interest were intimately intertwined and interrelated. The war served a small, very rich and powerful owners of the corporations and banks that dominate the world today. And it served especially the energy, construction, and military industries that stood to make enormous fortunes from the conquest of Iraq. It had almost unanimous support of the U.S. ruling class. And that's important to remember. But the oil monopolies and the energy dealers and the construction companies and the military industrial complex became the strongest champions for the war. They had the most to gain. They were driven by both ideology and self-interest. The Bush administration convinced the bulk of U.S. capitalists that U.S. world domination won and preserved using overwhelming military superiority of the Pentagon would guarantee that they would continue to profit and expand even if their competitors suffered and collapsed from economic crisis. Now, just to go into some of the background of this, I want to examine the ties of the individual government members to the monopolies I'm describing. First, members of the Bush family have blatantly used their political offices from father to sons to increase their personal fortunes. And they have also packed their administration with other politicians whose position and personal wealth are tied to energy and military industries. President George W. Bush himself is a Texas oil man. His company, Arbusto, merged with Spectrum 7 in 1984 as it was on the verge of bankruptcy. Spectrum was bought out by Harkin Energy in 1986, giving Bush a seat on Harkin's board, stock options, $120,000 in consulting contracts, and many, many, many other things. Then take Vice President Dick Cheney. He made millions of dollars after leaving the first Bush administration as CEO of Halliburton from 1995 to 2000. Halliburton's largest oil field services company, and Cheney continues to receive as much as $1 million a year in deferred compensation from Halliburton. Next, let's look at National Security Council Director Condoleezza Rice, a member of the board of directors of Chevron Corporation. Chevron named a 130,000-ton oil tanker after Ms. Rice. She served as her expert on Kazakhstan, where Chevron holds the largest oil concessions. There's Secretary of Commerce Donald Evans, who spent 25 years at Tom Brown Incorporated, a Denver-based oil and gas company. He was chairman and CEO of this $1.2 billion company and also sat on the board of TMBR, Sharp Drilling, an oil and gas drilling company. There's Secretary of Energy Stanley Abraham, also an executive of Tom Brown Company, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who, among other things, was director for Gulfstream Aerospace. His stock in the company reportedly was valued at $11 million when the company was acquired by a defense contractor, General Dynamics, in 1999. Many of the other cabinet members had connections to pharmaceutical industries, military industries, and banks. Like the usual U.S. government, the Bush administration represented the interests of the richest capitalists. Indeed, the Bush grouping was, though, an even more narrow grouping, and that it represented only a narrow spectrum of the very rich, mainly energy and arms corporations. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was the chief executive of Alcoa, the largest aluminum manufacturer. O'Neill was a standing member of the National Security Council, a longtime friend of Vice President Dick Cheney, a protege of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld during the Ford administration. He met one-on-one with Bush weekly during his 2 years as Secretary of the Treasury before he was fired for objecting to the Bush tax cuts. And that really leads to the second point, where I want to deal with Secretary of the Treasury Paul O'Neill's revelations, because they carry great significance. He was an insider, not only in the George W. Bush administration, but in quite a number of other past U.S. administrations. Paul O'Neill recently gave interviews for a book entitled The Price of Loyalty by Ron Suskind about his experience in the Bush administration, which he left in 2003. And especially important for this testimony is what O'Neill reports about how the Bush cabinet discussed war with Iraq and when they discussed it. In the book itself, Suskind recounts these early National Security Council meetings. January 30th, 2001, the very first meeting of the National Security Council in the Bush administration, which lasted less than an hour, the first topic was how the Bush administration was going to side with Israel and openly let Ariel Sharon have full freedom to attack the Palestinians without any restraint from Washington. Then, as O'Neill recounts, Bush turned to Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, and says, "So, Condi, what are we going to talk about today?" She replied, "How Iraq is destabilizing the region, Mr. President." And this was described as a scripted exchange. Then the CIA head, George Tenet, pulled out his infamous photos of an alleged chemical weapons plant, and they all huddled excitedly around the photos as though they had found the smoking gun. These were the same meaningless photos of a factory with unidentified trucks standing by that Colin Powell tried unsuccessfully to sell to the UN Security Council in the final stages of war preparation. 2 days later, on February 1st, the second meeting of the National Security Council, Secretary of State Colin Powell had been assigned the task of tightening up the sanctions regime at the first meeting. And O'Neill says in the book, Powell began discussing the new strategy for targeted sanctions. But after a moment, Donald Rumsfeld interrupted, saying, "Sanctions are fine, but what we really want to think about is going after Saddam. Imagine what the region would look like without Saddam and with a regime that's aligned with U.S. interests. It would demonstrate what U.S. policy is all about." At another point in the book, Suskind, through O'Neill, recounts that one document headed Foreign Suitors for Iraqi Oil Field Contracts, and it lists about 30 companies, including France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, their specialties, and in some cases, their particular areas of interest. An attached document maps Iraq with markings for supergiant oil field and other oil field and areas earmarked for production sharing, while demarking a largely underdeveloped southwest part of the country into 9 blocks to designate areas for further exploration and carving up. Susskind recounts that at the start of 2001, actual plans, to O'Neill's astonishment, were already being discussed to take over Iraq, occupy it, complete with the disposition of the oil fields, the peacekeeping forces, the war crimes tribunals that would be established, all carrying forward an unspoken doctrine of preemptive war. Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, the same people whose personal interests merged with their ideology, drove toward war on Iraq long before September 11, 2001, and long before there was any word of so-called weapons of mass destruction. After September 11th, they only stepped up the march toward war. Susskind writes of a briefing meeting on September 13th, 2001, 2 days after, before a national security meeting. O'Neill had received a short briefing before the meeting. What was guiding the discussion thus far was whether this was Al-Qaeda and its host, Afghanistan's Taliban regime, or the first step in a broader struggle against worldwide terrorism and numerous states that support terror. This is all quoting from the book. At a national security meeting the day before, just as O'Neill's C-17 was landing at Andrews Air Force Base, Rumsfeld raised the question of Iraq. The Pentagon had been working for months on a military plan for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Any initiative against worldwide terrorism would surely, at some point, Rumsfeld argued, take the United States to Baghdad. I raise all this because it really, again, confirms premeditation, planning, preparation for war. By the summer of 2002, it was really full speed ahead for war. It was only after, though, September 11th in the U.S. that the administration was able to mobilize the population for war. The assault on Afghanistan ended quickly and was apparently successful. And since then, however, Afghanistan has proven impossible to stabilize. But by the spring of 2002, the Bush administration was already preparing the assault on Iraq. And by fall, the campaign was in full gear. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, Conoco, Phillips, Halliburton, and Bechtel lined up for the contracts to reconstruct Iraq. Executives from these companies met with the staff of Vice President Dick Cheney in October of 2002 to discuss a future carve-up of oil territories in Iraq. And this is according to a Wall Street Journal article of January 20th, 2003. The war took place with all its horrors for the Iraqi people. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Rice, believed that they had a quick and easy victory over Iraq. They declared so by May 1st of last year. They believed they had the military power and that it was enough to turn Iraq back into a colony. They were arrogant enough to start looking for the next target in Bush's endless war. The discussions were Syria, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Cuba, Zimbabwe, and Venezuela were targeted for subversion. And the financial rewards went in both directions. On October 31st, 2003, the New York Times published an article stating that executives, employees, and political action committees of the 70 companies that received government contracts, adding up to $8 billion for work in either Iraq or Afghanistan, contributed slightly more than $500,000 to President Bush's 2000 election campaign. The overwhelming majority of government contracts for billions of dollars of reconstruction work in Iraq and Afghanistan went to companies run by executives who were heavy political contributors to both political parties. But they gave about 2-1 to the Republicans and more money to Bush than any other politician in the last 12 years. 9 of the 10 biggest contractors, and the biggest of these was Bechtel Corporation and Halliburton, either employed former senior government officials or had close ties to government agencies and to Congress. When Congress passed an additional $87 billion funding the Iraq occupation, and it's now approved an additional $20 billion for reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan, and much of it is going to these same corporations. And at the same time, I want to say that there are 40 million people in the United States today that have no health care, that education in the U.S. ranks about the bottom of any industrialized country, along with housing and social services, that life expectancy for African American men today in the United States ranks below. So this is a cost of war, and it's a global cost. But Iraq today shows that you don't always get what you want, even if you have great weapons of mass destruction. Many of the administration's friends are getting rich from this government money in Iraq, despite the failure of the United States to turn Iraq into a compliant colony. Much to the surprise of Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and company, the occupation of Iraq has aroused a resistance that has continued to grow since the supposed end of war last May. Casualties now are higher than they were during the height of what was considered the war. The momentum of the campaign for endless war has been drastically slowed by the determined resistance of the Iraqi people to brutal colonial occupation of their country. More and more U.S. soldiers are killed and wounded on a daily basis. This month is the highest toll of the war. Hatred for occupiers has spread throughout the country, and the attempt to set up a compliant yet stable Iraqi client regime has utterly failed. The Pentagon may have the world's largest military machine, larger than the rest of the world combined, but occupations can only succeed if they are unchallenged. The Israeli army is finding this out in Palestine and the Pentagon in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've not heard the end of the story in Haiti or even in Yugoslavia, the four places in the past 5 years that the U.S. military has forcibly occupied. One thing a successful prosecution needs to show is a motive for the crime. And I believe that the testimony today gives some insight to the motives of those making decisions for the U.S. government in waging an aggressive war against Iraq. The task of a people's tribunal like the one we're carrying has more moral authority than any of the tribunals set up in The Hague by the imperialist powers, because the task of this tribunal is to preserve the truth and bring the truth out before the people. It's an important task, but the struggle of the Iraqi people to free their country from colonial occupation, once again, is what is making people listen. It's what has brought the debate alive. Just 3 weeks ago, on March 20th, the anniversary of the beginning of the war last year, people came out in over 60 countries and close to 1,000 cities around the world to say no to occupation in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Haiti, and all over. The global movement that arose before the war is more tempered and sees now more clearly the lies and the fraud. And we need to continue to expose the crime and continue to mobilize the people to resist this war that has no end in sight and no solutions. The resistance in Fallujah, the uprising sweeping in Iraq, shows that they have no exit strategy. Their only solution is to call in for thousands and thousands of more troops, and that's what they're planning now. The PNAC reflected a narrow grouping that supplied the intellectual justification and ideological framework for a criminal war of conquest and colonial plunder. It's a war that has clearly enriched a few at a growing cost of many thousands of lives, and also the poisoning and radiating of one of the oldest centers of civilization. In the face of overwhelming resistance in Iraq and a growing global anger and mass mobilization, the PNAC and the Bush administration is being challenged in a way that they, in their arrogance, could never have conceived. It was not part of their plan. I think in closing, I just want to say, this is not the world of 100 years ago when only the rulers could plan or communicate and the average person didn't know what was happening in the next village. Today's imperialist forces face a literate population in Iraq that's trained in science and technology and trained in weapons and inspired by the Palestinian resistance. They know that it's possible to resist. And they also face a global movement in touch with each other, a movement, as we see here today, that is able to read and analyze their criminal plans and understand their conspiracies and organize resistance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah Flounders.